Eastern Affairs. Assalamu alaikum to you both. Thank you so much for joining us. Doctor, if I can start with you. So let's set the scene a little bit, especially as an Egyptian yourself. Egypt hasn't cut ties with Israel yet. You have Sisi, who, you know, constantly makes comments about his time with the Jewish community and how he grew up with them and normalizes, you know, those kind of links. And then you've also got the people of Egypt being suppressed from protest, and it took weeks for the crossing to even be opened. Why has Egypt taken this position?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First, we have to recognize that the Egyptian regime does not represent the Egyptian people. So are all Arab regimes. They are put in their place by the United States, and they are acting as the United States called them, client states who take their dictates from the White House and they implement it. And the day they don't do that, they will be out of power in their countries. Donald Trump said it clearly. The Saudi regime would not stand for 1 week without the American support. So it's very clear that those Arab regimes, they do not represent the people they rule. That's one thing. The other thing, Egypt Sadat signed the so-called peace treaty with Israel in 1979, which I call surrender treaty, because they got back the Egyptian land of Sinai, but they lost sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And the Egyptian army is not allowed to go into part of the land, which is Sinai, without the permission of the Israelis until now, after 45 years of signing this surrender treaty. The same King Hussein of Jordan signed a surrender treaty without getting anything. He could have insisted of getting back the administration of the West Bank or Jerusalem. He didn't. He just signed this surrender treaty for nothing. And I would say that Israel never withdrew from Arab land they occupy after the war of 1967 without such a humiliating negotiation for years. The Yasser Arafat gave up armed struggle with Israel after signing the Oslo Accord. Mm. Oslo Accord said that the Palestinian will have a state after 5 years of signing this treaty. Again, 40 years passed and the Palestinian PLO got nothing. They only withdrew without any humiliating treaty or any negotiation from Gaza and from south of Lebanon, thanks to the Islamic resistance in both areas. So when there is occupation, there should be armed struggle. When you give up the armed struggle, you get nothing but humiliation and ignorance. So Egypt, to come back to your question, of course the Egyptian people support Gaza 100%, but the regime cannot do anything. The Sisi's regime allowed the people to express their feeling and demonstrate only because of the pressure put to him by the Western government to open the Rafah crossing and implement the so-called deal of the century by the transfer of the Palestinian from Gaza to Sinai to live there permanently. Israel is saying temporarily, but the idea is to transfer the Palestinian and let them live in Sinai and leave Gaza for Israel to annex Gaza like they did with all the occupied Arab land.
And speaking of pressure, so it's not just the pressure that the people are putting on their governments in Egypt, it's also the pressure of the people worldwide that are now having an effect. You know, Noor, if I can come to you, you know, we've seen the huge question of our protests and boycotts working. You know, what's the use? We've got thousands of people on the streets. They're taking days off of work. Do they really have an effect? What can you tell us about these kind of protests across the Muslim world?
Yeah. So the protests that have been taking place aren't just across the Muslim world. We've also noticed all of these protests taking place in Europe, for instance, in London, where we had over 500,000 people marching together to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And the way I sort of measure the effectiveness of these protests and these boycotts is by looking at the reaction of elites. Look at the reaction of the Israeli lobby. Look at the reaction of Suella Braverman, for example, by trying to ban the Palestinian flag. Or, for instance, the reaction of Keir Starmer that fired Andy McDonald for simply asking for a ceasefire. These are sort of extreme measures, and the reaction from these from sort of the Israeli lobby and from Western governments goes to show how effective these protests are. And that's because, as well, the Israeli regime will attempt as hard as they can to make sure that the Western public opinion remains pro-Israel. So when this now that they're losing sort of the monopoly on the narrative, that then puts pressure on Western governments to change their stance towards the Israeli occupying entity. And we saw that with Keir Starmer, for instance, when he sort of did that U-turn, when he went onto LBC and incited genocide and said that Palestinians don't deserve water, electricity and fuel, and then had to U-turn the next day and go for photo ops with leaders of mosques, for instance. And so these protests sometimes can actually create tangible change on the ground. I mean, we saw the Iraqis that went to the border with Jordan and said that, you know, they refused for subsidised oil to go from Iraq into the Israeli-occupying entity. We saw protests happening in Egypt where people are camping by the border, by the occupied Palestine border, asking their government to open a Rafah crossing to allow aid and the injured to come in. These protests have erupted, for instance, in Jordan, where we've got, a massive population of Palestinian people. And that sort of, we saw that even Queen Rania had to come into CNN to now, even though Jordan takes the position of, normalizing with Israel and, has ties with them, but was almost felt obligated to come out and speak for the Palestinian people because it was almost embarrassing not to. Mm. The same with Turkey's Erdogan. He has open relations with the Israeli entity, but had to sort of come out and say the Palestinians have the right to, have the right to resistance because it simply would have been embarrassing not to say that. And when it comes to sort of creating real tangible change on the ground, the US may or may not call for a ceasefire if people, start to step on the US toes. If, for example, the people in West Asia begin storming the US embassies, they wouldn't want their interests sort of jeopardized. So they then might call for a ceasefire. And in terms of sort of boycotts as well. Boycotts have also been extremely effective. I mean, we saw McDonald's and Starbucks handing out, free burgers to the IDF as if, a lot of the IDF soldiers are actually obese. They don't need any more burgers. Instead of giving, food and fuel and donations to the people of Gaza that are literally facing a genocide, they have decided to, offer freebies and goods. And, these are capitalist multinational corporations, and where it hits them and hurts them the most is in their pockets. So I would say continue with protests, continue with boycotts, because they are effective.
Asante, I think that you mentioned quite a lot of the effects that have been enacted on the ground in lots of, not only just in the UK, but obviously in, you didn't mention Lebanon. I remember seeing this video of the people just literally like in their thousands, in their cars, just rushing to the embassy to kick these ambassadors out of their offices. And do you know what? As someone who regularly goes to these protests and actually asks people for their opinion, I definitely feel that feeling is coming to the UK. And what we're going to be seeing now is, in contrast to how many Muslim leaders have reacted, ordinary Muslims have also been active in showing their solidarity to the Palestinian people. Ayon Islam spoke to some attendees at a recent protest in London to ask them if they felt these leaders were failing in their responsibility to the Muslims of Gaza.
As a Muslim, it's shameful. It's absolutely shameful that these major world powers with a lot of wealth, a lot of oil, all they could have done was turn off the black taps, yeah? That's all they had to do. And they could have helped the narrative, okay? I think, turning off the taps to countries like America and Israel, that would have had a major impact, okay? And I think all the Muslim countries have been very slow talking about it, never mind the actions. The actions have not not come at all. If anything, Qatar has been outspoken about the whole thing. But again, there's a lot more they could do, and it's shameful. As a Muslim, I'm completely ashamed of the action or the lack of action or reaction from the powerful Muslim leaders of this world.
I don't believe this is a war just against Palestine, but it's an injustice and a war between the evil and the good, because that's what we're fighting. And I just want to say that we're not scared as a Muslim, as a convert. We're not scared. We trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We trust in God. We trust in the humanity. And they're all united that to this, to end with the Zionists. And that we know that even in the Quran says this has to happen. So we just have to keep our faith strong and remain together as humans. It doesn't matter what the big countries are doing or not doing. The main thing is that we remain together and we have our faith strong.
Now, the Muslim nation, there are 56 Muslim countries that could do a lot more. And so far, really happy to see what Qatar is doing. It's a small nation, and yet it's very involved and very vocal. They are keeping ties with Hamas, with the brothers as well, so with other Muslim countries, and that's how you're going to get support, whereas other Muslim countries have broken their ties with Hamas, which you cannot have a negotiation if you can't have a tie with them. Really disappointed with other countries. Yesterday, the United Nations had a resolution to push through for a ceasefire. As much as not binding and it's probably just a little soundbite, you've seen countries like Iraq abstain from it, Tunisia abstain from it. It's very shameful. At least speak out. We're not going to see anyone act on it. We're not going to see any sort of support from any Muslim countries. But for God's sake, at least speak out. When you have a voice, speak out and say something.
Well, no one can doubt that the views of the London population are definitely with the people of Gaza. Doctor, if I can come back to you. Nord mentioned slightly about the oil and, you know, the Iraqis going to Jordan. Why haven't the countries cut the oil? I remember that there was a statistic that said something like a sixth of the world's oil is with the countries. You know, if they were to cut the oil, that would cause a shock to the global economy, surely, and it would put the West on notice. Why haven't they done that?
Because we don't have statesmen in the Gulf area to do that, like what we saw after the 1967 war and 1973 war, where Faisal of Saudi Arabia cut gradually the oil production. He didn't boycott completely, but cut the oil production by 5% every month, and we saw the effect on the West on putting pressure on Israel. So we don't have statesmen to do that now. We don't have Arab unity and Muslim unity to see that killing and the genocide we see in Gaza today affect every Arab citizen in the whole of the Arab world and every Muslim citizens in the Muslim world. So if they have that feeling, they would have certainly hurt the Western interests, because the West is blindly supporting the Israeli genocide. And we hear Joe Biden saying that we will stand with Israel today, tomorrow, and every day. It means that forever they are supporting Israel blindly, which make Biden, the United States, and the Western governments complicit to the war crimes committed by the Zionist entity. So this is the situation now. While all the West are supporting the Israelis, none of the Arab world supporting the Palestinian really strongly and effectively. Okay, the Arab street is protesting and demonstrating, which is good in exposing their own regimes and their failure to help the Palestinians. But there is no action really to support the Palestinians by oil ban to the West, and also boycotting, as Noor said rightly. Where is the Arab boycott, which we used to practice until the 73 war?
Yes.
It made a lot of international corporations change their attitude towards this Arab-Israeli conflict.
You know, the question of Arab unity is definitely something that lots of people are talking about. And I think when Yemen kind of, you know, said that they're going to be, they've declared war against Israel, so many people in the Muslim community felt very empowered by it until they realized it was the Houthis who did it. And then yet again, you know, that brief moment of unity was like, oh no, they're the wrong type of Arab, the wrong type of Muslim.
Because the West call and Israel propaganda, any resistance to the occupation is terrorism. Any resistance to oppression is terrorism. When was resisting occupation and oppressors and land grabber called terrorism? Mm. So at least, again, as Noor said, the protest in the Western capitals exposed their regimes again, that what we are seeing in Palestine is legitimate resistance, it is not terrorist act. And as the Secretary General of the United Nations said, that Hamas attacks did not come out of a vacuum.
And that's definitely something that now the public are starting to acknowledge, you know, that they're moving away from this narrative of, oh, it's just started on the 7th of October. They're looking at it in a greater vacuum, absolutely. In a greater context. Noor, if I can come to you about Iran. You know, we were just briefly mentioning about, you know, Arab unity, Muslim unity. You know, has Iran done enough?
Okay. Well, Iran, unlike a majority of Arab countries, has stood by the Palestinian people from day one. If I can just remind everyone that during the 1980s, when Iran was going through one of the most brutal wars, where the world powers conspired against Iran in an 8-year brutal war, they still sent men to Lebanon, to South Lebanon and to Palestine to fight the Israeli invasion. So they have always stood by the Palestinian people and always extended a helping hand and never fell short in that sense. Compare that to, for example, the Palestinian Authority themselves, Mahmoud Abbas, when the Ma'badani hospital happened and the people in the West Bank went out to protest. And, you know, it was a televised genocide, a televised war crime that took place. And he shot at his own protesters, killing and wounding quite a few of them. Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, they've all been involved in sort of stopping the Yemenis from launching missiles into the Israeli occupation entity, almost protecting it. Just want to remind the world that Iran actually spearheads the resistance axis. What does that consist of? Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, the Palestinian resistance. In Lebanon, Lebanon is involved in a direct confrontation with the Israeli occupation entity on the southern Lebanese border and the northern occupied Palestine border. They have literally covered the entirety of the Lebanese border for the first time ever. Who funds and who supports the Lebanese resistance on the Lebanese border? It's Iran. You know, we've got the Yemenis. Who has supported them throughout their struggle when, again, the world powers conspired against the Yemeni people? They quite literally starved them to death. They were boiling and eating leaves for 8 years, and yet they still stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people and stand with justice. And so Iran, you know, when you ask Netanyahu, for example, who's the greatest threat to you, he will repeatedly say Iran, Iran, Iran. And therefore, that should be a clear sign that Iran is the only entity that is standing in the face of the Israeli occupation entity. It has also funded the Palestinian resistance that before the axis of resistance used to support the Palestinian resistance. Now it is the Palestinian resistance that supports the axis of resistance because they are positioned in such a strategic location within the belly of the beast, the heart of the Zionist entity. And they've gathered so much strength. Now when we say, you know, is Gaza standing alone? Is anybody supporting it? It doesn't even need anyone to support it. It is now a force to be reckoned with. The Palestinian resistance is a force to be reckoned with. We can now call the Palestinian resistance Arab leaders that are standing up for the Palestinian cause.
And well said, Noor, but I want to interfere here that we have to remind ourselves and the viewers that Iran, from day one of the Islamic Revolution, when Imam Khomeini went back to Tehran, he cut all diplomatic relations with Israel, he expelled the Israeli ambassador, and he gave the building of the Israeli embassy to the PLO at the time when nobody in the whole world recognized it as an embassy for the PLO in Tehran. So the support of the Palestinian case is a clear strategy of Iran from day one.
I don't think that there's any question on the fact that the resistance globally wouldn't be where it is if it wasn't for Iran's stance on this matter. What an incredible discussion. I wish we had time for more. Thank you so much to both of you. And thank you at home. I hope to see you again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome, dear listeners, to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Stay tuned.
جهنم هم میگن هفت در داره، هفت در داره جهنم ها. وقتی این هفته چرا هفته، چطور هفته؟ من دیگرش کردم، حالا به دیگران فرمودن، حالا به من هم بزنم.
In the ahadith and narrations we read that hell has seven gates. The question is, why seven gates? I searched a lot for the answer to this question and find its answer. The major reasons for our committing sins in this world are seven organs of our body: two ears, two eyes, mouth, tongue, and the sexual organ, which are totally seven. Through these seven organs, I violate the divine orders of Allah. In other words, through these seven organs, I am opposing Allah. These seven organ sins have effects on my actions and decisions that I make in life. This means that physical sins are not only limited to the organs, and they influence other aspects of our lives too. Therefore, there are seven gates in the hell, and there are seven entries for committing sins in this world, which must be taken care of.
جوانهی تابع جوارحیه، اونم تابع، ولذا هفت در جهنم هم داره.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Homeowners in Britain have been warned they still face rising energy bills this winter and will need to redouble their efforts to keep heating costs down over the cold months. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of This Is Money has covered this story and tells us more. A research revealed 3 in 5 over 60s with a household income of £20,000 or less have cut back on heating or powering their homes in order to make ends meet. Age UK said as the cold weather kicks in, 8.9 million or 54% of those over the age of 60 are worried about being able to pay their energy bills this winter. Not all government financial assistance is open to every pensioner, and eligibility criteria often apply, notably for pension credit. One unnamed 72-year-old man, ineligible for pension credit, told Age UK, "I don't know how I'm going to manage this winter." He added, "I've applied for pension credit, but got turned down, and because of this, I'm not eligible for the cost of living payouts this year." He added, "The only extra money I received is a £200 discretionary payment from the council. I do get housing benefit, but it still leaves me £200 short because my rent has increased." Meanwhile, a 67-year-old woman told Age UK, "I'm constantly economising. I wear extra clothes but do find my hands go tingly as I get cold. I don't drive and cannot travel easily due to ill health, and now can't afford taxis to get around or socialise. I try to shop around but cannot keep up with price changes in different shops. Money decisions make everything more stressful." A 79-year-old man told Age UK, "All of this year's state pension rise plus my savings is simply disappearing due to the huge range of price rises and cost of gas and electricity, council tax, home insurance, and the absolutely disgraceful continuing rise in all food prices." He added, "Absolutely everything has increased in price. Millions of pensioners are simply existing or living in fear about the future." The average home currently pays energy bills of £1,834 a year alongside sky-high costs for food, fuel and other essentials. Age UK said 7.3 million people, about 44% of those over the age of 60, have already cut back on social and leisure activities amid higher bills for basics like energy and food. It said that 2.6 million people over the age of 60 have cut back on their telephone, internet and water usage in order to keep costs down. Sky News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Caroline Abrahams, the director of Age UK, a charity organisation, said, "There's a rising concern about how some older people in the United Kingdom will cope when the temperature dips and they need to turn up the heat." She added, "Our new statistics reflect what we are also hearing on the Age UK advice line. Many on low and modest incomes are already fretting over how they're going to keep their heads above water when the winter bills start coming in." She added, "As ever, our biggest worry is that they will be so frightened of being unable to pay that they'll turn their heating down too low through the colder months, if they run it at all, jeopardising their health." Caroline Abrahams said, "After two tough years of this vicious cost of living crisis, some older people say they're unsure how they get through a third winter, having run down their savings and made all the economies that they can. That's why we're calling on the Chancellor of the Exchequer to announce more financial support for those older people who really need it this winter in his autumn statement, to give them the confidence and wherewithal to stay warm through the chilly weather." Caroline Abrahams, the director of Age UK, added, "Unfortunately, the experts say that energy prices are set to go up in January, dip in April, and remain at high levels for the rest of 2024. There is no certainty that bills will become manageable again in the near future, and this is bound to have a detrimental effect on older people's ability to stay warm and well." Caroline Abrahams said, "Given these forecasts, the British government must go further and do more to protect all the older people whose low and modest incomes place them in a precarious position this year and also next year." In October, Age UK said 4.2 million, or nearly a third of older people in the United Kingdom, had cut back on food and other groceries as stubbornly high costs continue to affect their living standards. Having savings can affect how much people receive in pension credit, but a rainy day fund of up to £10,000 will be disregarded if your income is low and other eligibility criteria is met. Age UK thinks there are between 400,000 to 500,000 households in Britain eligible for pension credit and receiving housing benefit or a council tax reduction, but not claiming for pension credit. Of perhaps even greater concern are the people who remain on a low income, but just miss out on meeting the eligibility criteria required for pension credit. Age UK said many will have meagre incomes that take them just above the level to receive pension credit, perhaps because of a small private pension or because the full state pension is set just above the basic pension credit rate. Not only do they miss out on extra weekly income and other discounts associated with claiming pension credit, they will also miss out on the £300 cost of living payment this autumn and the £299 in spring of next year. British newspaper The London Evening Standard has also covered the same story. British homeowners have been warned they still face rising energy bills this winter and will need to redouble their efforts this winter to keep heating costs down over the cold months. The cost of living crisis combined with rocketing gas, oil and electricity costs forcing millions of people to turn the thermostat down or off altogether last winter, which was a relatively mild one. Energy bosses fear a colder than average winter will leave many vulnerable families unable to heat their homes as much as they need to. The co-founder of one firm, smart thermostat maker Tadu, said 4 out of 5 customers turned their heating down last winter. Energy prices have come down from their historic peaks this year for following the extraordinary spike that followed Russia's war with Ukraine, but they're expected to stay at elevated levels until the end of 2024. The next resetting of energy cap later this month is forecast to result in a 3.5% rise in tariffs from January, lifting the average energy bill to almost £1,900. Dr. Craig Lowry, principal consultant at Energy Experts Cornwall Insights, said, "Our predictions for 2024 show prices continuing to languish well above pre-pandemic prices, something which is currently forecast to remain the case for the remainder of the decade." Christian Dielman, the smart thermostat maker, Tado's chief product officer and co-founder, said, "Last year's price shocks really focused people's minds about their household bills, and Tado customers told us that that was the main reason they were more careful about managing their energy usage." Christian Dielman added, "This is now a danger this winter that people will be complacent, but energy prices actually remain very high." Meanwhile, the amount of money British households owe their energy suppliers jumped to a record £2.6 billion this summer due to the surging wholesale prices and the rising cost of living. With the increase in bad debt levels expected to continue, regulator Ofgem said recently it's considering adding a one-time adjustment to the April energy price cap to reduce the risk of suppliers going bust or leaving the market as a result of unrecoverable debt. Proposals under consideration would add an average of £17 to all bills. Claire Moriarty, chief executive of Citizens Advice, said, "Worryingly, more households are running up energy debts during the warmer months, with some having to borrow money to try and keep the lights on." She added, "An increase in the price cap to pay for higher debts will make people's bills even more unaffordable."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing, this show in which we aim to assist you in bringing up your children under Islamic values. We invite you to share your questions and issues on this matter, and we have expert who will respond to them based on the Noble Quran and the teachings of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam. Oh, well, today again we have Brother Miqdad with us in the studio, and it's our pleasure to be with Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, rahmatullah. The pleasure is all mine.
Thank you so much for being with us. So, Brother Miqdad, it's been a couple of sessions that we have been talking about the concept of ikram in Islam, and yeah, that is giving self-respect to children, and you're helping us that how giving the self-respect in the family could help our children to explore in the social interactions.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we were talking about tolerance and the importance of tolerance that we need to teach our children. And we mentioned a hadith, a very important hadith, of how the best of everything in this world and the success of everything in this world and the hereafter goes back to mudaratul nas and the tolerance that we need to have between others.
Right.
And from the previous episodes, we explained that one of the major points about this is the ability to overcome our selfishness, overcome only looking at ourselves and accepting others, being helpful to others, overlooking, being lenient towards others, and being kind towards others. And this requires for us to put down, to put aside what we want always, or the feeling that we are always right, or the feeling that we are superior, or the feeling that it's only about our needs and others that come second. All that needs to be put aside. And for that to happen, we need, if that happens, that will lead to mudarat and lead to this tolerance. And the importance of this is great. And I want to say this way, that when we talk about tarbiyat of our children, we talk about upbringing of our children, many people ask about salah, how to teach kids how to pray, how to teach kids how to fast, and how to make sure that our girls wear hijab. All of that is very good. Definitely is very good, extremely important. There's no doubt about that.
Right.
However, this aspect of social akhlaq, this aspect of tolerance is extremely important. We have a hadith from the Messenger of Allah, peace be upon him, his family. He says, أَمَرَنِي رَبِّي بِمُدَارَاتِ النَّاسِ كَمَا أَمَرَنِي بِأَدَاءِ الْفَرَائِدِ. That Allah has ordered me to be tolerant with the people in the same way that He has ordered me to perform the fara'id, those right. things that are wajib. In other words, the same weight should be given to prayers and fasting and hijab as well as to the performance of mudarat and the learning of how to interact with one another, how to be lenient with one another, how to overcome this selfishness, how to be beneficial for towards others, how to be an active and a positive member within society.
Right.
How not to be only selfish and only looking at our own needs before others.
Right. And I think one of the key points in tolerance is forgiving others. So teaching our children how to forgive others. Because Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says in one of the very beautiful hadiths, al-afu zakatu zafar, you know, zakat of your success is forgiving someone. We'll discuss more with Brother Miqdad after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Please, stop! I got very
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this israf to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry, we're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. Englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Brother Miqdad, and we're discussing about tolerance in society. How do we teach that to children? By giving them self-respect and self-importance. Yes, Brother Miqdad.
So the question comes, okay, how do I teach my children how to be tolerant? How do I teach my children how to be and generous and sacrificing,
right,
and be able to appreciate the differences? And we want to bring back all of that to this idea of ikram, this idea of teaching children self-respect and the respect of the human being, and be able to understand that we are important.
Okay.
And once a person understands that they're important, they naturally adopt those values that are beautiful values, those mm-hmm. values that are values of perfection. You see, a person goes towards evilness, a person goes towards arrogance and a person goes towards selfishness when they don't have any self-respect left inside them. They don't count themselves as important. I mean, if you were important and you knew you were important, you would take care of yourself.
Right.
You would know that you want to beautify yourself. Mm-hmm. You don't want to let yourself rot, basically. Those people who allow themselves to rot, who allow themselves to go on the path of anger and desire and arrogance and selfishness, is they've abandoned themselves. They've mm-hmm. forgotten themselves. That's what the Quran teaches us. The Quran says you've forgotten yourself,
right?
You didn't give importance to yourself. You forgot how valuable you are. And by ourselves, we don't mean the physical selves. Yes, these people might be wearing very nice clothes and very expensive perfumes, but we're talking about the real self. We're talking about the true self of the human being. We need to teach our children that they are very important. And what happens is that when they really believe that they are important, right, they will strive to beautify themselves,
right.
Not their clothes, not their face, not their hair, rather their moral trait, their mm-hmm. human traits of perfection.
Right.
And they will understand that I need to be sacrificing, I need to be beneficial to others, I need to overlook what I need so that others can get what they need. And this comes with the self-respect. See, the link is very important over here. The more you give self-respect, the more you teach self-respect, the more you show love and kindness and you make children feel important, it has a very long-term effect. It goes a long way for them to become individuals who have ikram, right? Inna akramakum indallah atqakum. You see how Allah says that ikram, this respect comes with taqwa,
right?
That Allah has given you ikram. Allah has given you this honor, this respect. If you really believe in it and you really adopt it and you live a life of this self-respect, which comes through taqwa, then you really achieve a very important status.
Right.
So you find, for example, a person who, a child who will grow up or is growing up with the self-respect will never have hatred towards others, right? Will be able to control their anger and control their hatred, right? They would very easily overlook other people's mistakes towards or what other people did to them, right? Imagine you have a person who insults you or
right.
a person who even, for example, commits an act of injustice to you, mm-hmm. right? A person who has self-respect will oversee this, will not very quickly build hatred towards that. It'll count that as a mistake, will overlook it. You find that the Ahlul Bayt were like this, right? The Ahlul Bayt, when somebody would insult them, they would overlook it, right?
Right.
They would not get troubled, they would not get angry, they would not take revenge, they would not have this hatred. Rather, they would overlook it. They were
right.
rational. Remember what we said in the first episode. They were rational, they were not emotional, they would not react emotionally, react upon feelings. Rather, they would react in a logical way, in a very rational way. They were able to have this self-control. And they would not bear this hatred. Rather, they would overlook it because they want the best for others, because
right.
they're very tolerant, because they understand that other people can make mistakes, and I can overlook those mistakes.
Right. Brother McDowell will discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Imam Ali عليه السلام said, encourage your sons in their childhood to learn etiquette so that in their grown-up age they can be the joy of your eyes.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We are with Brother McDowell and we're discussing how to teach tolerance to your children. So Brother McDowell, you said Ahlul Bayt Imams have led us by example. If we have a look at their lives, they have lived very rational lives. They were moderate enough. They were not driven by the fantasies. They were at the same time very forgiving. They overlooked things, not keeping grudges. And we could teach all that to our children.
Well, a very beautiful hadith from Amir al-Mu'minin says, Al-mubadaratu ila al-af min akhlaq al-karam. The rushing towards forgiving others is amongst the akhlaq, the beautiful akhlaq, the akhlaq that has value and worth, right? Akhlaqul kiram. One of the things that we teach our children, again, when it comes with tolerance, when it comes with overlooking other people's mistake, is to forgive others.
All right.
Just as you mentioned before the break, that if somebody does something to us, a person who has self-respect, a person who is full, right? A person who is so full of beauty and full of perfection and full of kindness, they're very easy to forgive, right? They don't feel empty. You find that people and children who grew up with a lot of negativity, a lot of feelings, a lot of emotions, a lot of selfishness, right? You say one word to them and it's an explosion, right? An explosion of anger, an explosion of hatred, an explosion that I will never forgive you till the end of your life. I want to take revenge, right? You see, the difference is very clear between these two things. The question is, how do I bring my children to be forgiving?
The one who was very ideal.
Exactly. It's through making them full of respect, full of kindness, full of love, making them feel that they are respected,
loved,
important,
respected.
Full of love. And this what happens is, then they'll be easy to forgive. They'll overlook other people's mistakes.
So how important is it to respect your children, and how much it's going to affect their lives, and how much it's going to drive the way they are going to be good or bad human beings tomorrow? It's really important to give enough self-respect to your children so that they are the better human beings tomorrow. Even we have noble imams who say that the idealness is not the thing that when you have power and you take the revenge, the ideal person is the one who has all the power and forgives. Thank you so much, Brother McDonald, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returns upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The latest barrage of Israeli attacks on Gaza kills dozens more Palestinians. Women and children remain the main victims of the 39-day onslaught. The Israeli military kills 8 more Palestinians in the occupied West Bank amid an uptick in violence since the regime launched its war on Gaza.